I do want to thank you, Brother Obero, for the invitation. It's a great privilege to preach in personally one of my favorite churches in America. And then thank you for how you honored my parents last night as well. It was a blessing, blessing for me to see confirmation that others see the difference that my father has made and the heart that he has for other people. Maybe now we can convince my mother. Takes a lot to do that. When I was a senior in high school, I had the privilege of accompanying my parents on what was my first missions trip, and that was to the Philippines. I remember staying in the home of Fred Knoll and watching him try to get around in the condition that he was in, and it formed my impression of missions for the rest of my life. And I figured out firsthand why the Filipinos are so lovable. And they became my first love of missions, and through this church especially, have remained my first love of people in missions for my whole life. And then to hear Brother Obero refer to the people of this church and those in Mira Mesa as my parents' grandchildren, that's a blessing. And I can go back to my own kids and explain what really happened this last Christmas. Mom and Dad said it's because they were retired that they couldn't afford presents now. But what can you do when you have 600 other grandkids? We're sitting at supper last night, and my father asked me, how are you going to deal with the theme? I have two earthly heroes in my life. My father is one of them. Brother Davison is the other. And the part of me that comes from my other hero, Brother Davison, said, "What theme?" And so, Brother Obero, I sincerely apologize for not realizing that I was to stay with a theme, and I sincerely mean that. I can't speak for how sincere Brother Davison plans to be when the time comes. Mark chapter 8, verse 34. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, "Whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Father, we ask your blessing on the preaching of your word. Father, I ask your help in presenting it clearly, fairly, and accurately. And I pray that the message that I would claim that you've given me a passion for, that it would be able to be conveyed in a way that would be a help to the people in this room. I don't want to waste their time, and I don't want to do injustice to your word. So I ask for your help in conveying this truth. I want to thank you for these people and how they've already made the service so conducive to preaching, and may that time be used effectively. I ask these things in the name of Christ. Amen. You may be seated. I want you to notice in this text a particular flaw in fallen human reasoning that Jesus exposes here. He is teaching them, he begins by teaching them the importance and the wisdom following Him, and He is honest with them right off the bat about what that is going to entail and what that's going to be. And He tells them what following Him is going to mean, and that following Him demands denying themselves in verse 34, and that they're going to have to take up their cross. It basically, in at least in a simplistic form, that there's going to be some difficulty and some hardship. And so He's being honest with them in the beginning. Here's what it's going to take for you to follow Me. Now, because of who He is, because He is Christ, and He knows what is in them, and He knows what they think, any good speaker anticipates the argument of the people he is trying to persuade. And he understands this flaw in their thinking and in their reasoning, and he goes to work exposing this flaw in verse 35, but he particularly nails it in verse 36. In verse 35, this flaw shows a little bit in how they're trying to save their lives. Their reasoning told them that in trying to save their lives, all they needed to focus on was the saving. Jesus tried to show them that there was a loss side to this equation as well. If you want to save your life, He explains to them, you better think of both. You don't just think of saving. You better give some thought to losing as well. Or in the end, you may not like the result. But in verse 36, he makes it even more clear. The flaw really gets exposed. He says they could actually gain the whole world. I mean, gain all there was, and yet there end up being no profit. That actually it would be, shall we say, all in vain. There'd be no profit in the end. How could it happen that they could gain all of this and have no profit? By thinking only about what they gained and not spending enough time or little time thinking about what they stood to lose. And so there were two sides to this. And if you'll notice in verse 35, he is speaking about what they were trying to save, and in verse 36 about what they were trying to gain. But something that is common in both verses is what they stood to lose. And so he is in part, regardless of the application he's making, he is in part trying to expose this flaw in their reasoning that they were not spending enough mental ability or thinking time on what they stood to lose, only on what they stood to gain. Put it all together and it makes sense. Jesus is trying to get them to follow Him, but they are blinded by this fatal flaw in human reasoning. And it is, this flaw is this tendency to focus too much on what they stood to gain and not enough on what they stood to lose. And He's trying to get them to spend more time thinking about what they stand to lose. Because if they will adequately consider what they stand to lose in relation to what the world is offering them, He knows that if they'll properly think about that, they will follow Him. Because only when they do that will they not lose in the end. Verse 36 has always been such a tragic sounding verse to me. Because this is the thing. The tragedy of what they lost became greater than the success of what they gained. The problem with verse 36 is the tragedy of what they stood to lose would become greater than the success of what they stood to gain. And this is a flaw that still plagues human reasoning today. There is still a tendency to base the decisions we make and the changes we embrace on what we stand to gain with little thought to what we stand to lose. And that, in part, is what Jesus exposes here. Because the tragedy of what we can lose and what we stand to lose can become greater than the success of what we stand to gain. Once you understand this flaw that Jesus exposes, you begin to see it everywhere. I remember learning this in basic economics as a freshman at Oklahoma State University. The professor called it, and it is just a basic economics principle, called it opportunity cost. I was sitting there, and the professor was teaching, and she asked us how much it cost us to come to school that semester. One girl on the row that I was on raised her hand and said, well, it cost me this much in books, and it cost me this much in tuition. It cost me this much in meals and room and board, and she went through the cost. And so the professor then asked her, did you have a job before you came? Well, yes, ma'am, I did. All right, what did you earn in salary? And so she told her that figure as well. And she says, and so you quit that job to come here? Yes, I did. She says, so it also, to come to school, it also cost you what you lost in income. And the professor was trying to condition us to realize what the true cost of coming to school was. It wasn't just what we were paying for in coming to school. It was the opportunities that we gave up and what we lost as well. And her point was that without considering what we lost, our idea of value was an illusion. It wasn't a real value. It wasn't a real consideration of what the cost was, because we didn't consider what was lost. We were only considering what we were gaining at the moment. Another way that we might would see this principle that I think will resonate in here is speeding. When we only think about what we stand to gain, maybe 5 or 10 minutes, arriving somewhere 5, 10, 15 minutes early, and we spend all of our time thinking what we stand to gain, and we don't spend much time thinking what we stand to lose, maybe $200 in a speeding ticket and an increase in insurance fines, we might come to the conclusion that the tragedy of what we lost became greater than the success of what we gained. I can tell by the way that some of the wives are looking at their husbands that this application of this truth is rather profound, maybe rather recently by the looks of some of you. But the applications of the flaw that Jesus exposes here actually do get more serious, don't they? Lottery winners are notorious for focusing only on what they stand to gain and give little thought to what they stand to lose. In research for another message recently, I tried to go through as best I could and actually found someone who had done considerable research on lottery winners of the last 20 years and found where they are now and the state of their marriages and their happiness and even their criminal records where there was none before. And the list of casualties to marriages are astounding. And they were so focused on what they stood to gain, they gave little thought to what they stood to lose. And many of them now conclude the tragedy of what they lost became greater than the success of what they gained. A lot of debt is secured under this flaw. People sign on the dotted line and are so focused on the glamour of the gain that they don't spend enough time thinking about what they could lose in the end. And the tragedy of what they lose becomes greater than the success of what they gain. Is this not one of the reasons that the divorce culture is so rampant? So many are trying to get out of a marriage and all they can think about is the freedom from this marriage, and that divorce will bring so much gain that they don't look those kids in the eyes sometimes and realize that the tragedy of what they lose will ultimately overcome the success of what they might stand to gain in the end. Another man saw this problem about 25 years ago, in this case, in our use of technology, and wrote about it very persuasively in the book Amusing Ourselves to Death by Neil Postman. Now, this is a book that takes a solid reading to understand his point, and I have a very limited amount of time, so I'm going to ask you to really think as best you can, and I'll try to present it and make it as condensed as I can and yet still be clear, but you will have to think to get the point. He kind of marked the idea of that we started in America and even pre-America, that we had a typographic culture, meaning that most everything, the way we communicated, everything was in print. And if you think about the fact that print, for the longest time in our society, we have communicated by black text on a white page. That's been what we had. That's how we have gotten our information, in whether it was a book or a newspaper, and primarily in the form of books. But black text on a white page lends itself to the content and the analysis of that content. You don't have anything else to focus on. When I look at this Bible, really content is all I see because there's nothing else to think about. And its simplicity allows the mind to focus on the content because that is all there is. And what else would it focus on unless the mind strays to something else? But that's not the problem of the medium. That is just that may be the discipline of the mind. And when that was the medium, when all it was black text on a white page, you have to admit we were better thinkers. We were a deeper thinking culture. One of the ways that this has been expressed in the past is that not only was this evidence in our reading, but those who spoke, who had the responsibility of speaking and conveying thought at that time, reflected even in their speech this typographic culture, because the way they spoke reflected what they read and how they read. If you read the sermons of the 1700s and the 1800s, you realize how similar what was written and what was spoken, how close together they were. If you can comprehend that, there's evidence of when people would have their fairs, and the state fair, one of the great events would be like the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And in those debates, or when people would come and they would have speakers who they would have stump speeches, they would come and they would speak in these debates, even if it wasn't a presidential year, just to debate the issues, the masses would come together for this, and they would have two men debating the issues, and one would start off and he would speak for an hour. The rebuttal would get an hour to an hour and a half, and he would not give a prepared speech. He would literally have to respond to what the first one said. And the people were following these arguments. Then third, the first man would then respond to what the second one, how he rebutted the first argument that was given. And he would get an hour. And then fourth, the second one would respond to the second one's response to his first argument. And by the time they were done, this was common, they would go 4 to 6 hours, and the audience would stay there the whole time and follow it completely. Why? Because we had a content-based media that focused on the content. There wasn't everything else to focus on. That's all they had to do. They were focused on the content. Now, you take and contrast that to all of the gains that we have through television. And in that medium, it's not black text on a white page. Now you add color. You add focus. You add motion. You add sound. You add dimension. You have tone of voice. There's much to gain there. Look at all that we have to offer now in presenting the message. The problem is the focus ceases to be on the content. And now there is so much else to focus on that the measurement begins to change a little bit. Now it's not just that there is color, it's how many colors. And how vivid are the colors? And how much motion? And how realistic is the motion in presenting your message? And how much sound? And how realistic is the sound? And how many dimensions are there? And listen, listen, you need to get this point that by nature it forces the form now into entertainment regardless of what the content is. Because you're no longer, you don't just have black text on a white page where you can just think about the content and it forces you to think about the content. Now you have so much else to focus on, you're forced to think about the rest of it and you're forced to be entertained, and it doesn't matter what the content is, because now you think, oh, the colors could be brighter, and now we have millions of colors, and now you can have more motion, and you're not just judged by the quality of the content, you're judged by the vividness of your colors and the quality of your sound, and it must be a form of entertainment. If you're talking sports, that's okay. That's fine. It's fine to be entertained by sports. The problem with television and thus any multimedia sensory becomes that it turns any message into entertainment. Listen, in our culture, if it doesn't meet the right entertainment criteria, people don't care what the content is. They don't buy 42-inch LCD surround sound Bose systems to see black text on a white background. And it doesn't matter what the text says. People will not put up with that. They'll return that television faster than you can blink. It's not about the message, friend. It's about the entertainment. And Postman, who was lost, by the way, lamented the impact of television on the messages of religion. He says in his book, he cannot imagine why people would take such a serious, demanding religion and subject it to a medium of entertainment. And he did not comprehend multimedia like we have today. He could not comprehend why we would subject politics to that medium. Let me explain something. He would be surprised to realize, he would not be surprised to realize today, on television, do you know what the average amount of time is that a politician gets for a rebuttal? 90 seconds. People used to sit and listen to a rebuttal for an hour and a half. And television has now whittled that down to 90 seconds because the American public will no longer tolerate. It's not entertaining enough and it doesn't move fast enough. And he also lamented the impact of that medium of entertainment on education. Here's my point. It's not what you think it is, quite likely. While everyone else was thinking about what we stood to gain by television, there were a few thinking about what we stood to lose. And after some 75 years of the influence of television, I think the verdict is in. The tragedy of what we've lost became greater than the success of what we stood to gain. He was right. But here I am preaching to preachers. And I notice in verse 34, I understand it says, and when he had called the people unto him, but I also understand the next three words, with his disciples. And since I'm preaching to the GIBF, I am assuming that you'll either agree with me or tolerate me, that implies the church. And evidently, the church needs to have this flaw exposed as well. And preachers need this reminder, and I need this reminder, because it seems there is a whole religious environment today, so-called church movement, thinking only about what it stands to gain and not enough time about what it stands to lose in embracing everything that comes along. Os Guinness was right in his subtitle to his book, Prophetic Untimeliness: Relevance Has Become an Idol in churches today. Change has become a deity. Problem is, it's a golden calf type of deity. Any change today qualifies as progress. And the word progress has lost any sense of integrity. You realize you get to be called a progressive instead of a liberal, not because you made progress, only because you did something new. Only because you do something different. And any attempt to actually discern, was progress actually made before you deserve to be called a progressive, gives you then the title of becoming a legalist, and you don't get to define the term legalist in that sense. We don't understand what progress is now. It's just that we've changed, and so we call it progress. We need to realize the fact that something is new does not automatically mean that it is better. And the fact is, change is coming so fast in our culture that it cannot be tested for its long-term impact. Just as it would be in the churches that you pastor, there are some things at Bible Baptist Church that look pretty conservative and traditional, and that's not the same as saying backwards and lifeless. They're not the same. And over the years, I've noticed that people have made assumptions as to why that is. They'll come to visit, and I'll go visit in their home. And it's been interesting to hear their opinions as to why we are the way we are. I've heard some of these phrases. They're, to me, at times, they're humorous. Somebody literally made this statement before. Y'all don't get out much, do you? As in the fact that we don't go to other churches very much. Somebody else said about the fact that we were still using the King James Bible. Does your denomination not allow you to use something else? Somebody else has implied that the fact that we used the hymns that we use, that our elderly people must would really throw a fit if we tried to use something else. You've heard some of these. Some people assume that we can't afford all of the new technologies that come along. That's why we don't do it. I'm sure some people assume that drummers don't visit our church is the reason that we don't have drummers, whatever the reason might be. And I've had people say, don't you understand all there is to gain by all of these things coming along? I mean, don't you realize that it would help you to come into this niche of people, and it would introduce you to this segment? Don't you realize that it would help you to be relevant to these people, and that if this would bring people into your church, and that this will resonate with people in a way that you can't imagine? My friend, I honestly do understand to an extent that there are some things to gain by this. But that may not be the most important question. Jesus expects us to know what we stand to lose as well. And the fact that there are things to gain by throwing technology at the preaching of God's Word is not enough alone to justify its use. We have to ask, what do we stand to lose? Because we may look back 25 years later and be forced to admit the tragedy of what we lost became greater than the success of what we gained. There will always be new forms and developments in music. There will always be newer ways to introduce people into the church. Sunday school material will become increasingly intriguing. New forms of the church will continue to emerge. Church names will continue to evolve. There will always be new ways to package God's Word. And with almost all of these things, there are things to gain. There are some things to gain. That is not the question. You may throw me out. After this, I'll tell you, I have read Rick Warren. I've read Bill Hybels. These are not stupid men. I find them to be intelligent. And you can disagree with me. I find them to be very sincere. The pastors in the church, in the town where I pastor, I tell you, the ones down the street, I find them to be very sincere and what they're trying to do. She's trying to do the right thing. But you know why I don't do their stuff? It isn't because there is nothing to gain. It's because of what I stand to lose. And there are some things that I'm just not willing to lose. Because the tragedy of what we stand to lose can become greater than the success of what we stand to gain. Please hear me out. This is not an anti-technology message. This is not an anti-innovation message. You come to Bible Baptist Church in Stillwater, we love innovation and we love technology. This is a message of warning that we not get caught up in the spirit of the age. Not to the point of being blinded by the glamour of the gain. Not exactly sure how to pronounce his last name. Dean Inge said, "He who marries the spirit of the age will soon become a widower." Several years ago, John Nesbitt wrote the book Megatrends. I wasn't old enough to appreciate it. My father read it and appreciated much of it. He was one of many who was writing about what the future was going to look like. What made John Nesbitt stand out among the others is that now, looking back, about 25 years later, he seems to be the only one who was literally right on every account. Others actually, going back and looking at, of all those who wrote, John Nesbitt was right on every account. Somehow, he hit the nail on the head in everything that he wrote in his book, Megatrends, about what would be. Everyone wanted to know how he did that. How he was able to figure out what it would look like around the turn of the millennium. And so this last year, he released a book called Mindsets, in which he explained 11 mindsets, the way that he thinks, that allowed him to write Megatrends and not predict the future, but this is just how he thought things would look. The very first mindset in his book went this way: while many things change, most remain constant. That intrigued me. In his opening paragraph, he summarizes the whirlwind of change in our society, and his last sentence asks, "How do we keep up with it all?" And he answers with two words: "Don't bother." Listen, his point was this: why spend all your time focusing on all the things that change all the time, when it is obvious that the most important things are those that don't change? They're constant and they stay the same. Why chase those that are always changing? He concludes his chapter by mentioning Jim Collins' classic book, Built to Last. Those companies that basically stay the same and have lasted because of it, and they're not out there chasing every change that comes along. We here in this room deal with the local church. You want to talk about built to last? No company in Collins' book can compete with any church represented in this room. Isn't it ironic that the institution most built to last is so often given to change? Meddle not with him that is given to change. Jesus exposed a flaw in human reasoning. We tend to focus on what we stand to gain and fail to spend enough time on what we stand to lose. And if we don't constantly work to correct our fascination with the glamour of the gain, if we don't fix that, the tragedy of what we lose may become greater than the success that we stand to gain.